Hi, it's Michael Sinoff with Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Here's another great interview. The title is called The Little-Known Career That Could Earn You More Than $40,000 a Month Without a Degree or License. Whether you need a major career change or just a little side money, being a factor broker could be just what you're looking for. Ed Vigil has been working as one since 1991 and makes well over $40,000 a month in residual income doing it. It basically involves selling cash flow to businesses, and here's how it works. A factoring firm buys small business account receivables, giving them cash today on invoices they'd otherwise have to wait on. For example, let's say a janitorial firm has an account with IBM that pays every 90 days. They could wait for their cash, or they could go to a factoring firm and get most of that money right away. Getting it right away allows them to put money back into their business more times per year. The factoring firm takes a percentage of every receivable it buys, and as a broker, you make a percentage off of that. This is money you get for the life of every deal, so it's residual income that adds up quickly. And in this audio, you'll hear everything you need to know to get started, along with all of Ed's shortcuts and tips for making money right off the bat. You'll also hear the coward's cold call method Ed uses on every deal, and a step-by-step look at how he finds clients and lands deals. You'll hear common misconceptions about factoring debunked, why credit scores don't matter, why the IRS works with tax-delinquent businesses when it comes to factoring, how factoring is different from debt collecting or a depository institution, and more. You'll take a cold, hard look at how banks have begun to treat small businesses and why so many of them are turning to factoring nowadays. You'll learn all about the terms you need to know to look like an expert, such as advance rate, reserve fee, non-recourse versus recourse firms, and more. You'll also hear how much you can expect to make as a broker and the one realistic goal you'll want to shoot for right away. You'll also hear how to get banks to refer you to their customers that get denied a line of credit, why most will want to do this, and exactly what type of bank to go after. You'll hear the advantages of only working with two or three factoring firms, even though you could sign on to many, and a couple broker-friendly factoring firms you may want to contact first. You'll hear examples of some of the creative ways people use factoring. Believe it or not, you can sometimes use it as a cash down payment when buying a business. In this economy, many good businesses are in trouble simply because they've been denied loans and lines of credit and are forced to sit stagnant. Factoring gives them the cash flow they need to increase profitability so they can survive and even grow. Ed says it's easy to get started as a broker because factoring firms are not only friendly to newbies, they pretty much walk you through the process. And in this audio interview, you'll hear everything you need to get started today. Now let's get going.
Hi, I'm Michael Sinoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
How many years have you been doing this?
Started in 91.
So you've been doing this a long time. You're definitely an expert on the subject, and I know nothing about it, and I'm sure a lot of my subscribers know nothing about it.
There's not a lot to know. Factoring is extraordinarily simple, which is probably what works for me because I'm a simple man.
So where are you located?
I'm in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
All right, and so since 91, you've been doing this, and we're going to discuss what this is. Is that correct?
Exactly.
First of all, how old are you?
I am 48.
You're 48. So what were you doing before 91?
I was actually working for an investment bank in Los Angeles in the 80s. That bank went bankrupt, and I was waiting for some money that the bank owed me. So I was kind of thrown into the creditor kind of stuff. I wanted to keep doing things in the finance world, and really factoring was one of the few things I could do as a broker, and that was kind of my lead into factoring.
So in the investment banking world, you had experienced or known about factoring because you have people who maybe want to borrow money for their businesses or to buy businesses?
Exactly. Usually I was working with an investment bank that oftentimes worked with companies in trouble. So by that time, those companies already were factoring because they no longer were bankable. And factoring is one of those types of financing that it's not based on the company's financials, it's based on the receivable.
All right, so when you say that companies weren't bankable, meaning that there was no way they were going to get a loan from the bank?
Exactly. I think Kmart a while back was in some financial trouble, and they needed to continue to get supplies for clothes and stuff like that. A lot of the vendors that were supplying to Kmart no longer were getting paid by Kmart, because Kmart didn't have the money to pay. But the vendors still kept doing business with Kmart because they were able to factor the receivables from Kmart. It was a pretty stiff price because Kmart was in trouble at the time, but factoring is ideal for young companies, startups, companies in trouble, companies that want to increase cash flow.
All right, let's do this. Why don't we do the basic question, what is factoring? You can explain what factoring is, and maybe you can use Kmart as an example to take people through the steps.
Okay.
So what is factoring?
Factoring is basically the purchase of an accounts receivable from a company. That purchase is done at a discount to face value, and it's for a service that has already been performed or for a product that has already been delivered.
That may sound Greek to someone. So let's use Kmart as an example and explain the definition based on maybe an example that Kmart buys, you know, shorts from company X, and use that as an example.
A real simple example that I use of a janitorial firm. When companies are asking what I do, I tell them, well, I've worked with different janitorial firms. These are small companies. Maybe they have a contract with IBM to clean their offices. So they clean the offices for IBM, and IBM is going to pay them. IBM typically will not pay them for 30, 60, 90 days. It's been getting longer and longer. But janitorial company has a receivable. They have an invoice that they've sent to IBM for the services they've done, and they've got to wait to get paid. What they can do with that invoice is they can take that invoice to a factoring firm, and instead of waiting the 30, 60, 90 days to get paid, they can get paid immediately from that invoice.
I see. It's a way to accelerate and cash out on your services that you've already performed, invoices
exactly.
That you've already invoiced reputable companies that have a good chance of paying their bills.
Does not have to be a reputable company. The factoring firm will do a credit check on the company. The more reputable the firm is, like an IBM, the lower the fee the factoring firm will charge. But that same janitorial company might also be doing Joe's Garage right down the street. And they could factor that invoice too, but instead of paying a 1% or 2% discount or fee, they might end up paying a 7% or 8% discount because there's a higher credit risk with Joe's Garage versus IBM.
Who is doing the factoring? Are banks doing the factoring? Who's sending the money to the person who needs the cash flow?
There are numerous factoring firms. There are banks that do factoring, but there are literally thousands of factoring firms out there. If you do a Google search, you'll just be inundated with the number that are out there. And especially like in the last 3 or 4 years, a lot of your higher net worth individuals are looking for yield. So a lot of them have started up factoring firms because the returns on the money are really, really good.
What are the returns between what and what?
If you're an investor in a factoring firm, and let's say you buy an invoice at 1% and they're doing that every month, well, you're getting a 12% return annualized. If you're doing it at 2%, you're getting a 24% return annualized.
So 1% per month.
Exactly.
Use an example. I'm a janitorial firm, and I have $10,000 worth of invoices that haven't been paid. I come to you as the factor, and my credit is very good. After you run a credit check, you're going to charge me 1% of the account's receivables per month, or 2% per month?
That's where people get confused. Your credit has nothing to do with it. The receivables credit is what's checked out.
That makes sense. I see.
It's a janitorial firm, and let's say you have horrible credit. The factoring firm will run a credit check on you, but the only thing they're looking for is to see if you have an IRS lien, because if they buy the receivable from you and you need that money, the IRS might step in right away and take that money right away. The janitorial firm's credit does not matter at all. other than just to see if there's any liens on there. And factoring firms are really good at negotiating with the IRS already, so even that's not a problem.
So if I had an IRS lien and you took on my receivables and provided factoring services for me, they're going to actually try and negotiate with the IRS to get that money rather than having the IRS take it, or explain that?
Exactly. The reason the IRS will work with factoring firms is the IRS needs to have an ongoing company to collect on that lien. The last thing you want to do is have the company go out of business and they can't get that money anymore. So a factoring firm, that's basically their argument. They'll say, let us fund these receivables. The company continues to go and it continues to grow, and they'll be able to make those payments to you. And you can do a monthly draft of X amount or whatever. Factoring firms are really good at negotiating with the IRS, and the IRS is already used to negotiating with banks and factoring firms on deals like that.
That's interesting. At what point does the factoring firm have the rights to go negotiate? How far into the process does that occur?
When they do the application and then they run the credit check on the owner and they see that there, that's when they'll talk to the owner and say, hey, you've got this IRS lien. If we're going to pursue this factoring relationship, let us talk to the IRS first and then we'll take care of this. We'll get it arranged and then we can start funding.
Nice. So my credit as the janitorial firm isn't important. It's the credit of my accounts that owe me money that's important.
Exactly.
So if I have 100 different accounts, is the factoring company going to investigate the credit of each one of those accounts?
Yes. And that's one of the advantages of having a factoring firm, especially if you're a smaller firm. Not only do you get immediate funding and working capital, but oftentimes for a small firm, a factoring firm becomes your accounts receivable department. And they actually work with you to establish credit limits on the companies that you're working with. You may think locally that there's a company that's really well known and you want to give them really big credit lines, etc. A factoring firm will go in there and they'll investigate their credit, Dun & Bradstreet, etc. And they'll say, well, we could probably advance you $10,000 or $20,000 with that particular company. That becomes your credit line, that you immediately know what that company is credit worthy for.
Even though we've discussed some of the advantages of factoring, let's recap for the listener. What are some of the advantages of factoring?
One is that you get immediate funding, and that's probably the biggest one.
When you say immediate, how long would you say the process takes? Let's say you just got me as an account. I have receivables. I say, Edward, I need money ASAP. How long is it going to take before I see that money in my account?
The application process is entirely up to you, how fast you get the paperwork to me. But it's typically a 1 or 2 page app, so that might be 2 or 3 days to get that done. Once you're set up as an account with a factoring firm, you can potentially get paid the exact same day that you get your invoice, if you get the invoice in earlier enough. Or typically it's within 24 hours.
Now, you mean when I invoice my vendor?
Yes. So you would fax the invoice to the factoring firm as well, or a lot of them are set up to do electronic receiving, and 48 hours is a long time to receive your money. You'll get it that fast. So immediate funding is helping you out with your working capital. Like I mentioned before, it can also become your accounts receivable department, especially if you're a smaller firm. I find that companies that are $1 million and under in revenue, those are the ones where they really like having a factoring firm as their accounts receivable department, having all that kind of stuff.
So what services will the factoring firm provide for me? Let's say I turn over all my invoices to the factoring firm. How are they going to help me keep things going smooth?
One is the credit department. They help you establish credit limits for your customers. Two, the reports that you get from the factoring firms, they give you the aging on the receivables, payment records, etc.
How often do they provide those reports?
Those are available online with most factoring firms, so it's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
In the janitorial business, I have 100 accounts that are being factored. They're all going to be online, and I can monitor that 24/7.
Exactly.
Shows which ones have been paid out, percentages, all that.
Exactly.
So how does this differ from, like, I have a book of accounts, people who have promised to make payments, say, on an information product that I sell, monthly payments, and I have many declined credit cards, so I have bad accounts. What does a factoring company do with something like that? Is that something they would touch, or do they only want the good paying stuff?
That's the biggest misconception. Factoring firms are not collection agencies. Factoring firms purchase good accounts receivable only. Now, this is a business-to-business transaction. So what you were talking about there is a business-to-consumer transaction. When you write off an account and it goes to collections, it's no longer factorable. If you have an account that's 30, 60, 90 days past due, but it's within a firm like IBM or something like that, that's normally what's happening these days with business-to-business accounts. I would say just as a rule of thumb, and I know that rules of thumb are dumb, but if an account goes past 120 to 150 days, probably not factorable. But within that, 30, 60, 90 days, definitely a factorable receivable. You mentioned the credit card. Factoring has kind of gone into a lot of different fields. One of the things that a lot of people are doing now is there's something called a merchant cash advance. And that's where these firms are coming and saying to small mom-and-pop operators that have merchant accounts, we'll lend you money against what you're receiving on those merchant accounts, on your credit cards. Not the declines, but what you're getting on the credit card accounts. And they'll go in and they'll do just a history of what you're doing, how much per month are you doing, and what is your decline rate, et cetera. And they'll advance you money against that. And that actually is a form of factoring, probably the latest form of factoring that is out there right now.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. What are some of the terms one should know when it comes to factoring?
I'd say the big three are you need to know reserve, advance rate, and fee, because those are the ones that are directly related to the factoring transaction. The fee is basically what the factoring firm is going to charge for purchasing that receivable. When I first started back in 91, I was kind of like a hard money guy. It was really hard to compete. Rates might have been 9, 10, 11% discount fee. Now, it's gotten really competitive. So you're seeing fees of 1%, 2%, 3 or 4% maximum on most of the transactions I submit now. So fee is the fee that the factoring firm is charging. The advance rate, let's say you have a $100 receivable. The factoring firm isn't going to advance you $100. They're going to advance you X amount of it. Again, when I first started doing this, it was typically 60 or 70%. So if you had a $100 receivable, they'd give you $60 or $70 right away. Now, it's not uncommon to have that 80 or 90% advance rate immediately on the receivable. That 20% that isn't advanced or 25%, that's considered the reserve. And the reserve is paid to you as soon as the receivable pays. So there's the advance rate, there's the reserve, and there's the fee. When that reserve is paid, it's when they typically take out the fee. Some of the other things you should know are recourse and non-recourse. A lot of factoring is non-recourse, which is what a lot of people like. In other words, if the receivable goes bad, then the factoring firm is responsible for that. They don't come back to you. They don't have recourse to you for collecting on that. If it's non-recourse, then they come back to you to say, hey, this receivable went bad. Typically, a factoring firm will just ask you to replace one receivable with another receivable.
So what determines whether the account is recourse or non-recourse? Where is the line drawn?
A lot of it is really just the factoring firm itself. A lot of them like to offer recourse. Other firms offer non-recourse. If it's a non-recourse deal, you got to figure that's going to be priced into the deal. A non-recourse fee is going to be a little bit higher than a recourse deal. It's just case by case, factoring firm by factoring firm. A lot of them want to do it. A lot of them don't. As you do your research on the firms you want to work with, that's what you'll see as part of what they offer.
All right, so you were in investment banking. You were looking for other things to supplement your income. Now take me back to how you came across the factoring and how you got started.
Bankland bankrupt. I was out on my own. I knew of people that were basically brokers doing brokering. We were bought deals by men and women that were brokers. And I had some relationships with some of these factoring firms just in the normal course of business doing my stuff. I don't want anybody to think I was a high-level investment banker. I was basically at the associate level and just doing due diligence work and things like that. But because I was aware of factoring when I was on my own and the bank went under, I just reached out to some of these factoring firms. And the great thing about factoring firms is almost all of them love working with brokers. Basically, it's like you're a commission sales force of bringing them business. So why would they turn you down? You're very broker-friendly. And that really was my introduction to it. Started working with a couple of firms initially. Found out that there were a lot more factoring firms doing other things such as medical factoring, construction factoring. Factoring is in a lot of different fields. And you just sort of grow as you learn more.
You hooked up with a broker. Let's say, for example, your first one. Did they teach you the ropes? Did they tell you what you wanted? How did you know who to call, what to do, what to say? How did you gain that experience?
They taught me the ropes as to what is factoring. And almost every website that you go on for a factoring firm will give you examples, and they'll talk to you about what is factoring. The website is their marketing pitch to a firm when they go to it. But back in those days, there was no website, really. I was just given, here's a script, here's what you do, here's who you call. Really just any business-to-business firm out there. Because really 90-plus percent of all business-to-business work that is done on a receivable basis. The market is huge. And they signed me up on a broker agreement, and it just went from there.
What's a broker agreement going to look like? Let's say I want to become a broker in California. Do I need to be licensed?
No. There's no licensing for factoring or to be a broker. The broker agreement, you want to look for a couple of things. Standard commissions right now are 10% of the fee that the factoring firm gets. So let's say a $100 deal, and I'm just using round numbers. If the fee is $2, you get 20 cents of that. So it seems small, but the deals are actually bigger than that.
And it's ongoing.
This is residual. Exactly. It's ongoing. Now, there are some firms out there, they'll say they offer it for 6 months or 12 months or 18 months. You want to sign up with those firms that say that they gave you the commission for the life of the deal. That's what you always want to see in your broker agreement, life of the deal. So that as long as a firm is factoring and selling their receivables to that factoring firm, every single time that they do it, you get a commission. It's residual, life of the deal. As you get more time into it and you start working more with a firm, your commission rate can go up to 15%. I have a few that pay me a little bit higher. Usually when I'm talking to guys who are just getting into the field, I tell them, set yourself a goal of $1 million. $1 million is always my number. That's a good one to shoot for.
A million a month.
Sounds like a lot, but if you think about it, a small firm might be factoring $40,000 a month. So you're looking at 25 accounts there over the course of a year. Just about everybody who's really serious about this can get 25 accounts. It's very common to get $80,000 a month deals, $100,000 a month deals. Those are not big deals in the factoring world. Once you get that $1 million a month in factoring receivables, you're looking at anywhere from $2,000 to $3,000 a month in income. I don't want anybody to think it's easy. It comes down to your marketing. And we all have our different styles of marketing. I have my style of marketing, but if you're willing to pick up the phone and make the phone calls, the business is out there.
Can you share how you've done over the years financially?
I'm probably in the $20 to $30 million a month range right now with what I'm factoring right now.
You're bringing in at least $20,000 a month every month?
Yes.
Wow, and that's just ongoing.
But I've been doing this since 91.
You're doing more. You're doing $40,000 or $60,000 a month.
I'm doing well.
That's beautiful.
Like I said, it's simple. It's just a matter of picking up the phone. I don't consider myself a good marketer. I consider myself one of those guys who just pounds it out. My style of marketing, I call it the coward style. I make phone calls at night when I know nobody is there at the office, and I'll leave a message with the president or CFO of a company. And then the next day I'll call and talk to them. It's a little bit warmer because they know my name already because I left a message. But you're selling money is what you're selling. And it's not so hard to get through the gatekeepers.
When you've had the experience and you know what to do and you know what to say.
Exactly.
Wow, that's very exciting.
When I talk to a secretary or a gatekeeper, when I call them, I'm calling them to say, I want to purchase accounts receivables from your company. A lot of times they don't know what I'm talking about, but they heard the word purchase. I'm not trying to sell them something. I'm trying to buy something from them.
Well, let's do a role play. You're going to call me. I'm Joe's Air Conditioning and Heating Contracting. Joe's Air Conditioning and Contracting, may I help you?
Hi. Is John or David available?
Now, how do you know it's John or Dave? Have you pre-researched?
Okay, researched already, yes.
So you've got a list of the owner's names?
Right.
Do you want to talk to the owners only?
I do. If the company is bigger, I want to talk to the C-suite, the CEO, CFO, COO. $1 million and less, I'm probably talking to the owner.
All right. This is John. I'm the owner. How can I help you?
Hi, John. My name is Ed Vigil, and I left a message with you last night about purchasing some receivables from your company.
All right. Stop right there. Now, when you say that, percentage-wise, how many times have they heard your message already?
Most of them have already heard it because I make the phone calls usually in the afternoon, so most of them have already checked their messages in the morning.
Okay. So that's going to make sense, and it's going to ring true. Yes, 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 Edward, I did get your message. Is that what they say?
Yeah, and then oftentimes they don't know what I'm talking about. They'll say, yeah, I got your message. Are you a collection agency? And that's what I get a lot. My response immediately is, no, I'm not a collection agency. We're looking to buy good receivables from your company. I'm looking to buy anywhere from typically $100,000 to up to maybe $2 or $3 million per month in receivables. Do you have that amount of receivables? And then they'll start talking to me a little bit more about what their receivables are, what they have. And they already know this as well. I think they know it intuitively that it's really the amount of times that you turn your cash that leads to profitability. In other words, if you're turning your money over 4 times a year, you've got X amount of profit. If you're turning that money over 6 times per year, your money is working more for you and you're increasing your profitability. So I go into a discussion about that. I have a little sheet that I fax them on, just basically outlining that.
At what point do you fax that sheet to them? After the first phone call?
After the first phone call. Now, I'm not a one-call closer. I know there are some people that are out there that are one-call closers. I'm just not that kind of salesperson. But typically after the first phone call and after faxing that one-page sheet, I'll talk to them relatively quickly afterwards. And that's where we start talking more in-depth what kind of receivables they have. Are they looking to factor? In my opinion, I think every company out there should have a relationship with a factoring firm. Once you sign a contract, you don't have to immediately sell all your receivables to a factoring firm. You can sell just 1 month's worth of receivables, or you can just keep them as a backup, and whenever you need a cash inflow, then sell some receivables at that time, or you can sell them on an ongoing basis.
Let me ask you this. Before you call them, tell me about the research you've done. You've got a list of people you're contacting. Is that list been checked for what else other than the owner's names?
I'm looking for revenue size and owner's names.
Now, what's the sweet spot for revenue size that you like calling on?
I like personally that $1 million to, say, $20 million in revenue.
Why?
It's easier to reach the C-level suite. They're also at that level where they may be needing some cash flow help. They may be looking at expanding or not expanding. In the last 3 years, there's been a huge influx of where banks have literally cut off lines of credit for companies. And these are companies that were making their payments on time on these loans, but because of different regulations and different things that banking regulators have said, they've had to really just bring in capital and cut off these loans. And so I've been talking to a lot of companies that were basically left hanging without any money. As a matter of fact, a lot of my marketing recently has been to bank officers talking about how we might be able to establish a relationship, etc.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. How often are you seeing this and hearing about this currently? What is going on with the banks now? It's June of 2013.
It was primarily starting with real estate. Banks had to increase the capital that they had on hand. The thinking is that the more capital you have in the bank as a cushion, the safer the bank will be. So they were trying to call in loans from commercial real estate and that kind of thing, but a lot of those loans went bad. So they couldn't get capital back into the banks from those loans. Banks also have a lot of line of credits. Remember, factoring is not a loan. Factoring is an asset purchase. But banks had loans with a lot of good manufacturing companies that had never missed a payment, never been late on payments, but they needed to get capital back into the bank, so they started calling those loans. One, stop the line of credit. You no longer have access to more capital. And two, we need you to pay off whatever you have on your line of credit because we need that capital back in the bank. Because of regulatory things, they needed to up their capital standards. So good companies were being left just bereft of any cash, any lines of credit. And so the last 2 or 3 years have been really good for factoring firms. They just sort of stepped into that void that was there.
Is there a way to identify prime prospects by researching which banks are pulling lines of credit and going after businesses that are dealing with these banks, where you have a list of specific businesses dealing with these banks that you can find from a list broker and call on?
I wish that there was, and if anybody knows of one, let me know. What I've been doing is I'll go to just different banking regulatory sites, and I'll look for banks that say that they're in trouble, and you can see that by how many negative loans or bad loans that they have, and those are the ones that I sort of target when I'm calling bank officers. And my pitch to a bank officer when I call them is, you know, hey, I would love to work with you on any of those lines of credit that you've had to withdraw. We are not a depository institution, and that's big for the bank officers.
Why? Why is that big? Why do you say that?
They have a relationship with these manufacturers. Even though they've pulled away line of credit or the loan, they still have deposits that manufacturing firms have with their bank. So those deposits are important to them. And there's usually other relationships like a treasury function and things like that. Factoring firms don't take deposits, so we're not threatening that depository relationship that banks have with those firms. Almost all factoring firms don't tie the firm into a long-term relationship. They literally can factor with a factor firm, and when the banks are ready to offer a line of credit again, they can just stop the factor relationship and go with the bank. They would want to do that because lines of credit are cheaper than factoring.
Now, have you scored some good accounts by dealing with the banks who reveal and set you up with clients who have had their lines of credit pulled?
Yes. It's probably about a third of the marketing that I do now. is calling on banks and speaking to bank loan officers. Just by the nature of way loan officers are set up, they typically are given a portfolio of loans when they start with a bank, or they build up a portfolio of loans. So they may have $30 million worth of loans that they have in their portfolio, and they're also expected to generate fees off of that portfolio, either treasury function, deposit fees, just all these different things that they're expected to do. But when they're told that they have to get rid of a relationship, especially a line of credit, they don't want to be the guy that says no. They don't want to be the guy that says, we're dumping you. They'd rather say, we have this other solution for you. We have another way that we can keep our relationship with you on the depository side and still help you out with some of your cash flow type problems through a factoring relationship.
But aren't all halfway decent banks going to have some kind of relationship with a factoring firm already, or is it just not that widely done?
I think more and more they're starting to. There's guys like me calling up a lot of the loan officers and giving them the exact same spiel. But there's still a lot that aren't. And I focus on the community banks. I don't go to the regional banks or the money center banks. All of your money center banks already have a factoring division, and most of your regional banks have factoring divisions. A lot of your community banks don't. And so that's where I focus on.
So how do you establish your credibility with that loan officer that you're legit? And if you're a broker, you have multiple resources for the factoring, or are you dealing with just one or two?
As a broker, I have multiple resources. But just as a matter of fact, I tend to work with three or four factoring firms that I'm really comfortable with. I do a lot of small manufacturing firms, and that's kind of a niche that I work. But if somebody has a trucking company looking for factoring, I'll go out there and find a factoring firm that specializes in trucking and sign a broker agreement with them and refer the deal to them. As far as establishing credibility with a loan officer, really I think it's just your level of expertise in the product. When I'm talking to them about what we can do and what we can't do and how we can help their firm.
You talk about how you can help them just stay on their problem and solution.
Exactly. It's about building a relationship. And as soon as they send you one, you better perform. If they send you a manufacturing firm and you can set it up for factoring, you better do it right away. If you can't, you better explain to them why you can't right away.
You've been doing this since 91, so what's a typical day for Edward look like?
Usually at nighttime, I'm doing my research, researching companies. I'll go to Hoover's, and there's some other stuff that's free with my local library that I'll start researching for whatever market segment, $1 million and $2 million or $2 million to $5 million, and getting the names of the contact people.
Are you doing this every night or a couple nights a week?
I don't have much of a life, so I do it most nights.
Okay.
Hey, I enjoy doing it. So I'm building my lists, and then I'm also making some of the phone calls at nighttime as well.
95% of the time or 100% of the time, you're leaving a message, right?
Exactly. So my nighttime is doing the research and making phone calls.
How late will you make a phone call until?
I can call like at 1 in the morning or 2 in the morning. Manufacturing firms typically close at 5 or 6 in the evening.
I think it's a good technique. I mean, look, it's working for you.
During the day that I started doing my marketing, using the afternoon, probably calling the list that I've called the night before, and that tends to take more time because now I'm engaging in conversations. So it may take me a whole week in the afternoons to work the list that I made the first calls on that nighttime. And typically in my mornings, I'm actually working the deals. Somebody says that they want to factor some receivables, I send out the agreements. I'm following up. Hey, did you get them? Hey, did you send them in? Did you send in the paperwork?
So you're dealing through phone and mostly email?
Yes. I'm talking back and forth with a factoring firm. What do you think the rate's going to be? They came up with this question. What do you think about that?
Do you have a point man at each one of the factoring firms?
Yes. This is what I did initially. I think I signed like 80 broker contracts. But really and truly, when you have a relationship with two or three factoring firms that you feel really comfortable with, you want to do most of your work through them. And then it builds up credibility for you, too, as you start sending more deals to them. They return your calls faster. They do the underwriting quicker, that kind of thing.
Tell me a story of one of your most exciting deals you've done. Like one that you've been like, oh, man, this is great. Like, you know, it's a lot larger than you thought. Just an example. Anything that sticks out in your mind?
It may not be super exciting, but I was really pleased with the results. I was working with a steel fabricator. They did a little manufacturing of metal parts. They were doing about $2 million in sales. Their gross profit was about 27%. Their net profit was about 2%. It was really, really close. You need to have some good margins to be able to factor. It was pretty close on whether I was going to be able to do anything with them. But they were cash constrained. they were buying their inventory in small lots because they didn't have enough money to buy more inventory. But this was a manufacturing firm that had the ability to produce more if they could get more inventory to build it. Some of their goals were they wanted to get current with their vendors. They wanted to increase the amount of inventory they could get so that they could sell more and debt-free of some of the working capital loans that they had acquired. Set them up on a factoring agreement, a factoring facility. And just by that cash being freed up, instead of staying in receivables but now being immediately available because of cash, and remember I said it's the amount of times that you turn over money that increases profitability.
Explain that. So a listener hears that, but it's not making sense to them. How is it that a company increases profitability by turning over cash more often per year?
When you have a receivable that pays you in 90 days, and let's say that's the average, your receivables are turning over in 90 days. In other words, they're paying you in 90 days. Effectively, you're able to turn over your money four times a year. So for a good amount of that time, your money is just tied up in a receivable that you can't do anything with.
You can't invest it. You can't make interest on it. You can't do anything with it.
You can't buy inventory with it. Exactly. So for 90 days, you're tied up, and then when you get paid 90 days out, all of a sudden you have cash, then you can do some stuff. Then your next receivable comes in another 90 days later. So you're turning your money over four times a year. What happens when you can all of a sudden, say, turn it over six times a year? So you're getting your money quicker. So now you can buy more inventory so that you can produce more, and now you can start selling more, and then you can turn it over again even quicker.
Oh, because you have a lack of cash flow, you have a lack of growth opportunity because you don't have the liquidity to grow.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, I have even seen some companies where they had so many sales that they sold themselves into bankruptcy.
They couldn't grow. They needed the cash.
They were strangled because of a lack of cash.
How can one use factoring to buy a business, for example? Or I guess maybe the business owner who wants to sell doesn't know about factoring and they have receivables and they never considered that they can use the factoring to help finance the sale.
So if you're the person buying a company and you see that a company has a lot of receivables, typically it would be written into the note that, let's say, the down payment would be paid 10 days after closing, something like that. So if you're the smart acquirer, the smart guy that wants to buy the business, and you've done your due diligence and you see all the receivables that are on there, as soon as you have control of the company, and hopefully you've already got a relationship with a factoring firm, as soon as you have control of the company, you immediately factor those receivables, and that becomes your cash down payment. And that's the model I've seen on a couple of transactions where they've done it that way. I myself have never been involved in a merger and acquisition where it was done, but that's what I've seen how they do it.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's Hard-to-Find Seminars. So let's say I wanted to get involved and become a broker and start selling some factoring services. You said there's no licensing involved. Do I need any money to get started?
You need no cash to get involved. I guess let me preface it by saying you should have a telephone line, you should have a fax line, you should have internet, but I think everybody pretty much has that these days. I work out of a home office, and so really if you can just set up a basic home office, really and truly it comes down to your marketing. Are you willing to pick up the phone and make the phone calls? Are you willing to just follow up?
Have you seen other factoring companies use direct mail as a means for generating accounts compared to phone calls?
You know, back in the 90s, I used to see more of it. I think now a lot of everything is done with your websites and search engine optimization and that type of marketing. I don't see the direct mail as much anymore. And really, a lot of your factoring firms depend on your brokers. They have a really good relationship with brokers. It's a very broker-friendly industry. So a lot of them don't really compete. That would be competing with the sales force that's out there. So a lot of them don't really do that. I haven't seen a lot of that anymore.
Okay, so I don't need a license. I don't really need money. I need a phone line, be willing to pick up the phone. Do I need a website as a factoring provider? Do you have a website?
I do not have a website. I basically just talk to C-level executives or owners of companies and just give them the basic outline of what factoring is and do you want to pursue it. That's my marketing. On occasion, I have a little life cycle of a working capital dollar that I'll fax or email.
So do you set goals for yourself as far as numbers every month that you'd like to do? How do you keep motivated?
I kind of am starting to work with a smaller market. In other words, I really enjoy working with entrepreneurs. I really enjoy working with small business guys. I'm working on a $9,000 purchase order right now. 10 years ago, I don't think I would have been interested in working on that. But the guy is a great guy. He's trying to start up a sign company. He's really enthusiastic. So a lot of these smaller guys are really energizing me with their enthusiasm and what they're doing. And so I really enjoy working that. Before I would set goals, I wanted $1 million in receivables. That was my very first goal, $1 million a month in receivables. And then once I hit that, my next one was $2 million, then $4 million. That was my number. It was the amount of receivables per month that I could get factored.
Let's say I'm a manufacturer and I get a PO from a reputable firm that is credit worthy and it's a purchase order, say, for $500,000. Is that as good as gold? And why should I go to a factoring agency and not just ask the bank to lend me money based on the PO?
We haven't even really talked much about purchase orders, but most factoring firms, and not all of them, but most of them also do purchase orders, and they look at it as kind of like a precursor to receivables. If they fund the purchase order, then it's going to create receivables, and they like to keep the whole relationship there. I've never worked with a bank on a purchase order. Just by their very nature, banks tend to be very paperwork intensive, very credit intensive. It just seems to me that they're going to want to know everything about you, about your company. They're probably going to want to have personal guarantees.
So purchase orders really aren't as good as gold with a bank.
I'm not really experienced enough to say that. I just think it's a much more difficult process to work with a bank on either factoring or purchase orders than with a factoring firm. But purchase orders are good as gold if you have them from a reputable company. If you got a purchase order from Walmart, that's money in the bank.
Through a factoring company or a bank?
Exactly.
What is the future of factoring?
There's one firm out there that I've had my eye on. The company is called the Receivables Exchange. So if anybody wants to Google it, just Google the Receivables Exchange. They're based out of New Orleans, Louisiana. And really what they're doing is innovative. I think it's the way that the industry is going to go. The only problem with the Receivables Exchange is they're not broker friendly. I have basically a broker agreement with them, but the terms in which they pay me just take too long for me to get paid, and I'm not really interested in that part there.
What are they? How long does it take to get paid?
90 days.
And what about your other relationships? How long does it take for you to get paid?
Oh, once a month. So with the Receivable Exchange, what they've done is they basically set up a market for receivables. And by that, I mean it's an electronic exchange, kind of like the NASDAQ. And a company signs up with the Receivables Exchange, and they basically just list the receivables on the exchange. The Receivables Exchange has gone out, and they've gotten primarily hedge funds to sign up as funders to buy the receivables. And again, the hedge funds are doing it because they're looking for yield. They're looking for higher rates of return, and they can really juice up their returns by purchasing receivables. So when you list your receivables on the Receivable Exchange, you might have 5, 6, or 7 different hedge funds bidding on that receivable. And so really that drives the cost of selling the receivable down, actually quite substantially. And I think that model is going to be the way it's going to go in the future. I think you'll see a lot more of that. But I also think that the broker is still going to be important. I believe the Receivable Exchange is probably suffering because they're not broker friendly. They could have a lot more deals online on that exchange if they worked with brokers versus the way they're working with them now. I think the broker will always be involved because it's just pretty expensive to have your own sales force, and brokers do a really good service in what they do. I just feel that the Receivable Exchange is the way it's probably going to go in the future.
Very interesting. Now, as a broker, can you get sub-brokers under you or agents under you, kind of like a real estate broker?
Don't hold me to this. I want to say no. Their sales managers at the factoring firms are the ones who are responsible for signing up brokers, and I imagine they probably get an override some sort. But I don't know of any factoring firm off the top of my head that allows you to set up sub-agents or sub-brokers.
All right, very interesting. Wow. So, Edward, you should put some kind of information product together. Why don't you put a report together that kind of outlines your formula of how you do it, and then we can put this recording up. You can offer a report for $97 or something like that. You can sell that, and then you can have people call you, and you can offer some consulting for these people if you're into it.
I would be interested. It's just such a simple process.
Well, it's simple when you're doing it, but for someone who has no idea how to do it, you've got a formula. You've been doing it since 91. You can use your Coward cold calling method, which is a genius strategy right there.
Oh, Well, thank you.
And it would appeal to really anyone. No one likes picking up the phone. I mean, but that's a great way to make your phone calls more effective and make it more of a warm call than a cold call. And I would imagine it's effective or you wouldn't be doing it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It works for me, definitely. I'll think about putting something together. And I just want to make sure that I give value. I don't want to charge $97 and give them like a six-page thing.
Well, it's not the amount of information, but if you went through your steps, outline what you do. So if you look at your day within a 24-hour working day, so you're doing the research at night. You make an outline, like an outline of a book. Research, what websites do you get your names? Every little thing you do, make a little outline, and then just write out what you do, what's important, what you would tell your brother to do to get into the business. Make sure you're calling on the owners. Make sure you're getting businesses between the 100,000 or 2 million, some of the stuff that we talked about. Even if you make the outline, do you have an iPhone 5 where you can just talk right into your phone and transcribe a little section on each note about your outline, and you put a nice little report together with URLs and specifics and give people a primer, and then you can have your information at the end of that report for more information if you get stuck. Then they can call you and you can charge consulting fees for that time on the phone. If it's worth it. I mean, you're making great money doing what you're doing. You may not even want to be bothered with it, but you could position yourself as the expert in factoring as a broker.
I'll have to think about that. I really will. You know, I do love what I'm doing already, and it does keep me fairly busy, but I do enjoy helping people. If anybody calls me, I wouldn't be charging them for that, but if I can make a difference in somebody's life, I love seeing that. And I have helped other people become brokers.
How many people have you helped over the years to become brokers?
15, 20.
And have you seen them go on to making good money?
Yeah, I'm just talking about the ones who made good money, who've gone on and made it a career. I think I've talked to hundreds of people, but very few actually do it. I belong to like a local investment group here in Albuquerque, and I almost pleaded with people 2 years ago because factoring was really exploding because of what was going on with the banks. And I said, this is a great time to be in factoring. Give me a call. I won't charge you anything. I'll show you the ropes. I think I had one person call, and that one person really didn't want to pick up the phone and make the phone calls.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Senoff's Hard to Find Seminars. But you have had some people who have used your advice to gone on and make good money?
Yeah.
What's an example?
I had one guy in California, and this is probably the late 90s. He was a tailor, but when I went into him, his customer service was just outstanding. And I told this guy, you know, you were just great with your customer service. You call me back on everything. Have you ever thought about just selling money? Because that's in essence what I do. I sell money. He was intrigued by it, and he was just in a position where he had the time, and he was aggressive. He was willing to make the phone calls, willing to do the work, and really in anything. I'm sure there's very successful people in Amway because they're willing to do the work that they tell you to do.
Did you ever hear back from him how well he did?
Oh, yeah. It's a career for him now. He actually has his own small factoring firm. I cherry-pick some deals. I buy some local deals here in town that I can actually put my hands on, that kind of stuff.
Where you become the factor, you'll be the lender as well.
I only do stuff that's here in Albuquerque, but when I typically would do like a 2% fee or 3% fee, annualized that's 24% or 36% return.
So how many of those deals have you done since 91?
I really only started doing it the last 7 or 8 years.
So what gave you the idea to start doing that?
It was here in Albuquerque, a janitorial company. And literally, I use IBM as an example, but that actually is the deal that I did. There's an IBM sales office here in Albuquerque, and he was doing the janitorial for them. And I just thought, you know, he's local, he's here, I know him real well.
You had the money at that time.
Right, and IBM, I don't think I can go wrong there, so I'll just buy the deal myself. You know, I was so used to being just a broker and just selling the deal to the factoring firm. Now I had to do a little legwork and do the actual what they call UCC-1 filing.
What is that?
That's basically declaring to the world that you have an ownership interest in that receivable. Kind of like a mortgage says to the world that the bank has a lien on a house.
And you have to file it with your local courthouse?
Yeah, with the state. It's just a simple process. It's a one-page paper.
No big deal. So you do the filing. Did you have to get an attorney or anything?
Maybe I should have. I didn't. It was just such a simple deal.
Is there a standard contract?
I just actually copied one of the contracts from one of the factoring firms is all I did. Most of the contracts are pretty standard, and that's all I did. I just copied one of the contracts I had and filed a UCC and just started buying the receivables.
Annualized, that was 20-something percent on your money?
Yes.
Is that still going today?
It is.
So how many years has that been going on?
7 now.
7 years. So generally, these deals can go on year after year after year.
You know, what's really great is a lot of times these companies kind of get hooked on factoring. It's such a simple process, and then you can also get your money so quickly. 24 hours, 48 hours is slow in the factoring world today. You send your receivable, and typically within a day, you've got that money hitting your bank. Again, when I was talking about banks, the whole paperwork process, then they do the credit checks on the company, then they do the credit checks on the individuals, then they'll require personal guarantees, and it's worth it when your company gets to a certain size, because it is cheaper to have a line of credit than it is to have factoring. And before the recession hit, I kind of took it as my responsibility that when a company hit a certain size, I would tell them, hey, you probably should look at a line of credit now. Now, after the recession, a lot of companies just don't even want to consider going to a bank right now.
All right, so look, this example of this janitorial firm. So how do you work it with IBM? Are the invoices now coming to you, payable to you, or are they still coming payable to the janitorial firm? How do you work that out?
Still coming payable to the janitorial firm. I have, you can call it a lockbox, I have a P.O. box, so I changed the address of where the payments were sent to. Instead of going to my friend's office, it goes to my P.O. box.
So you'll change the payable address.
Exactly.
So IBM will send the checks made out to the janitorial firm, but to your address, and what do you do with that check?
Because he's local, he just signs them over to me. A lot of factoring firms, when they do it, they typically have a stamp that's made where it's assigned over to them.
Yeah, they'll get the company to sign, pay to the order of.
Exactly. But with this guy, he's local, so I just go to him and say, sign these.
And he'll go pay to the order of your group, and you just make the deposit.
Exactly.
Any tax advantages as far as earned income from you with this type of business that anyone may benefit from?
I'm not a tax guy. I set mine up as a C-Corp back in the 90s, but I only did that because there was no LLCs back in 91. Maybe today I would have set it up as an LLC. But there was a myth at the time. I think I've heard you talk about him. There was a guy named Gordon Bazar.
Yes.
So I went to one of his courses, and he was like, sign up as a C-Corp, and then the banks will find you immediately bankable because you're not an entrepreneur, but you're an employee, and they like that. So I thought that was true, but that turned out to be a lie. Any bank, when you want to go to a loan to them, one of the questions they ask, are you a 50% or more shareholder in any company? And as soon as they see that you're 51% or more, they know you're self-employed.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. So with your deals you're cherry-picking, was that a non-recourse or a recourse deal with the janitorial?
Mine is a recourse, but I never had a problem. And when you cherry pick, I'm only doing stuff here in Albuquerque. Maybe I might consider something in Santa Fe. But I want to be where I can actually go to the door of the company and meet with the guy directly, and that's my comfort level.
Is there any fraud in the factoring business where maybe companies are submitting false invoices to get money?
Yes.
How do you protect yourself from that? Or is that really not your problem? You're just a broker.
As a broker, it's not my problem. It may become my problem if the factoring firm says, can you talk to these guys? Can you give them a call before we come in and crack the whip? But it doesn't happen as much anymore. You got to be pretty sophisticated to do it. Because remember, the factoring firms have a credit department. They're running credit checks. They're doing their background checks on the receivables that they're buying, which is a plus of having a factoring firm in your corner because they help you with that. But if somebody is determined to carry out a fraud, they can do some pretty sophisticated stuff. You do hear about occasionally where a firm has to go to court and sue. Usually, most of the time when I see something where a factoring firm has to go to court, it's almost always because the firm that was the receivable, like say IBM, accidentally sent the check to the guy selling the receivable and he cashed it. And that's usually the scenario where I see it. They go to court.
He cashes the check and takes the money from the factoring.
And takes the money, right, and never gives it back to the factoring firm. That happens on occasion. I was going to say, you got to be a pretty sophisticated crook to pull one over on a factoring firm.
So what sounds like a real opportunity for maybe the listeners is listeners who want to invest in something is learn the business, cherry pick some local deals, and earn 20, 22, 25, maybe up to 30% a year on your money.
I'm a firm believer, and I do this with everything. I do more than factoring, but the bedrock of everything I do is factoring. Almost everything that I do, I start out in a broker role. For example, I was partial owner of a property and casualty agency here in Albuquerque, but I never put any money into it because I don't know anything about P&C agencies. But they needed somebody to run the business, during the day, and so I ran it because I wanted to learn what was going on. What are the inner workings of a PNC agency? And that was kind of like a broker role. I was stepping in, not putting any money, because I wanted to learn about it first. Going forward, if the opportunity were to rise, then now I know enough about that that I would invest money into it. I always tell people, always start out, if you can, in a broker role, whatever it is, so that you're actually originating deals, you're putting stuff together, and you're learning about the deal, you're learning about the process, or you're learning about the receivable. And then when you know enough, that's when you can step in and start making your own direct investments.
You had mentioned, I think in one of the emails, you cringe when you hear about people spending thousands of dollars on cash flow seminars to learn this stuff.
I do.
So what's a warning for anyone who wants to learn factoring when you have a lot of promoters out there promoting the educational aspect of cash flow?
One, don't do it. You don't need to spend that kind of money. Factoring, number one, is so simple. It's a simple process. You buy a receivable at a discount. That's all it is, really. And number two, almost every website for every factoring firm explains the processes, explains the advantages. It's all there for you. Number three, when you sign an agreement with a factoring firm, I don't really know of any that are not broker-friendly, even for newbies, because if you think about it, they'll put the time into you because they want you to bring them business. They want you to bring them deals. This is a very, very broker-friendly industry. Even for new people coming in, they'll help you, walk you through it. If you call up a factoring firm and say, I have a relationship with this company, and I heard they were looking for some money in that receivables, can you help me? They'll be all over that. They'll walk you through the steps.
Do you want to recommend a couple maybe very broker-friendly firms that are reputable and easy to work with?
Actually, I had a couple of websites I was going to say you might want to check out. You can go to Commercial Finance Association, and their website is www.cfa.com. Those are all asset-based lenders, and factoring is asset-based. There's a difference between cash flow lending and asset-based lending, and so you want to talk to asset-based lenders. So cfa.com.
You were going to explain the difference between cash flow lending and asset-based lending. Let's do that.
The United States, historically, was an asset-based lending country. In other words, if you wanted to get a loan, you had to have an asset to loan against.
We used to loan against gold.
Exactly, a loan against gold. Most people know they can get a loan against their house. That's an asset-based loan. And that's the way it was for most of the United States history. It was an asset-based lending country. Maybe in the late 60s, 70s, there was this new thing that came along called cash flow lending. And specifically, it was that banks would look at a company's cash flow and say, okay, you have X amount of cash flow, we'll lend you X amount of money against that cash flow, which was fine as long as people did that, as long as they stayed with, you have a cash flow, we'll lend against it, and that's it. I think I mentioned before, I was like a hard money lender in the 90s. It was hard for me to compete against cash flow lending because their rates were so cheap. Cash flow lending just went all the way overboard to the point where they actually started lending on what's called pro forma. So pro forma is Latin for as if, I believe. So you could be a real estate developer, a hotel developer, and you could make a plan for a hotel. And you could say, I'm going to build this hotel, and we're projecting that we're going to get this cash flow. So even though it was just an idea and there was no actual cash flow, banks started lending against pro forma cash flow. And that's where we started getting into some of these crazy things that eventually exploded on us in 2007, 2008. And that's why factoring really had a resurgence this last few years, because things went back to asset-based lending. Going forward, I think you're going to see a mix of asset-based and cash flow. But I think the only people that will qualify for cash flow lending are the big guys, the real estate investment trusts, your big companies. I don't think you're going to see cash flow lending being available to the ordinary small business guy just trying to pitch a deal.
So you really kind of have your pulse on the economy because you're seeing the workings of lending. How do you feel the economy's doing right now compared to 3, 4, 5 years ago as far as lending? Is it loosening up? Is it still tight? Is it getting more restrictive? I know we've talked a little bit about credit lines being taken away.
Yeah. I see it as still pretty tough. There are asset classes, again, factoring, and I know that I'm pro-factoring. Factoring is probably one of the best games in town right now. I think banks are still in a position where they're having to clean up balance sheets, and I think there's a lot of uncertainty about a lot of things regulatory-wise that they're not ready to open up the spigots yet. So I see there's as much entrepreneurship as there ever was. People still want to build businesses and create businesses. There's just not the capital available. The capital is there. Banks have money. Insurance companies have money. They're just not putting it out right now until I think there's more regulatory things going on in the economy, where it's more clear what's going to be going on. Business people adjust, and things will work out, I think. But right now, it's just still pretty tough.
That's interesting. All right, Edward, well, this has been good. It's a great gig for someone who wants to get on the phone and make some good money.
You know, you're selling money. You're not selling soap. You're not selling widgets. It's something that I think everybody will listen to you as you talk to them.
So if some of my listeners want to pick your brain a little bit more, would you be willing to talk to them?
Of course. Like I said, I don't have a website, but I do have a toll-free number. My toll-free number is 866-626-6186.
All right, that's perfect. This has been very informational and educating. So that's Edward F. How do you pronounce your last name?
It's a Spanish name. It looks like Vigil, but it's pronounced Vigil.
Vigil. Ed Vigil, Managing Director of the Adragon Group.
Well, hey, thank you so much for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. That's the end of our interview with Ed on how to make money as a broker providing factoring services. For more great marketing interviews and business opportunity ideas, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com.